I'm going to start the recording. Like I said, we're recording this for the podcast. My name is John. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hey, John!
For those who don't know me, I think most of you do, I've been in program for a little over, actually coming up on 31 years.
Wow.
In October. About 16 years of abstinence. I'm also in another program and have almost 31 years of sobriety there. We decided, in talking with Sheila a couple months ago about workshops, I brought up the idea of doing a sexuality workshop because I believe a lot of these issues that we'll enumerate in a second were the underlying cause why a lot of us ate. And they're certainly one of the underlying causes I have seen in people who come in, are successful in program, but then go back out. Because there's a lot of stuff that comes up that didn't come up until you've had some time in program and lost weight and had to deal with this. And so I think it's a crucial part of talking about it. You know, neither of us have all the answers, but we can talk about it and share and commiserate some of the various things that happen. I lead OA retreats around the country and actually Canada too, so I guess two countries. And on Saturday nights, I usually do one of these workshops because I think they're important. They bring out incredible depths of sharing. They bring out incredible emotion, but they also are an incredible catharsis for people who have a lot of stuff wrapped up around all this. And so that's what I wanted to talk about. Well, I'll talk about this in a second. Just to go over what we're going to talk about. First of all, we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. But when we talk about sexuality in a workshop, there are different parts of it. When April and I were saying, well, how are we going to break this up? How are we going to talk about what is a very large subject? We decided part of it. One part is body image and attractiveness and self-esteem. Another part is dating, the dating mating dance of which we have to deal with, a lot of us. Then there's sexuality itself, the actual physical acts, things like that, and intimacy. Now, intimacy and sexuality are not the same thing. In fact, I remember hearing somebody say once, sex can sometimes be one of the most unintimate things in the world, and intimacy could have nothing at all to do with even physical contact. And those who are in a long-term relationship know there's a big difference. We're also going to talk about relationships in general, and then, you know, the big L question, love, you know. In terms of a man and I'll edit that, both of us happen to be straight. When it comes to straight, gay, I personally don't think there's a huge difference. It's the same set of feelings. It doesn't matter how this goes out. Maybe there are little specific things. But for the most part, I don't think anything we're going to talk about is specific to heterosexuality. These are feelings, these are people, and it's all the same. We talked about when we were going to break this down, we decided we would, you know, we're going to start out and each of us will talk a bit about just ourselves. I don't think we're going to tell our stories as such, other than how it pertains to this. But then we decided what we would do is we decided to break up this whole workshop into three discrete parts. The first, and then each of those discrete parts will have a time where we'll share. We will have basket that'll go around. People have questions, and we find it a lot easier for people to write down questions than to ask them from the floor. And then we'll have open sharing as well. And we're going to do, the first one will be on body image, attractiveness, self-esteem, that kind of thing. Maybe some dating will come into it. The second will be on sexuality itself. And then the third, we decided to leave open as an ad hoc thing, depending on what we hear from you want to talk about, or if there are a lot of questions, we may end up making that more about that. But rather than be really rigid, we decided to sort of go with the flow as to hear what you guys wanted to talk about. As I said, we are recording this, and we're going to have sharing. So if you don't want your name used, please just use a pseudonym, you know, or say I'm anonymous, whatever you want. But we are recording this for podcasts because there are a lot of places around the country that don't have the kind of intergroup we have here that really would like to hear this. Also, I passed this around once. I'm going to pass it around again. There is Asket Baskets. These are for the three different topics, and you'll see there's three different colors of paper depending on which of the topics, whether it's the one on body image, whether it's the one on sexuality, or the one about something that doesn't fall into either of those two categories. And we've been sending them back and forth, and if we would just sort of keep rotating them back and forth, because just because this basket goes by, you may go by and you haven't thought of a question yet, and then all of a sudden, geez, I know what I want to ask. So we're going to keep these baskets just sort of going back around the two sections, and there's going to be a static basket sitting on the back table so that you can always just walk back and write a question down, and then when we get to it, we will ask, we will look and see what kinds of questions you have. So anyway, that's just sort of the housekeeping stuff I wanted to get out of the way. So, no 12-step. Does anybody have a big book with them? Could I get a copy of it for a second? No 12-step sexuality workshop would be complete without me telling this joke to start out with. For those who don't know, this, you know, sex is a big part of recovery in all 12-step programs, and you know, it was a time when a guy came and wanted to talk to his sponsor about sex, and the sponsor, being a good 12-step big book thumper, said, I want you to go back and read what it has to say about sex in the big book. And ironically, in the big book, it's on page 69. Make your own joke there. Well, and the big book actually does say we treat sex like any other problem, and we deal with it by asking for help from our higher power, looking at what our part in it is, having especially to do with selfishness, things like that. So it's a very good thing for that sponsee to read. But the trouble is that sponsee was dyslexic. So instead of going home and reading page 69, he went home and read page 96. So when he went to see what the sponsor said to read about the big book, this is what it said. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Seek out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept your, with eagerness, what you offer. So anyway, it's just always always a good idea to start with a joke. So again, I came into this program 31 years ago. I was 26, 27, somewhere in that area. And I had been fat my whole life. I had been a fat kid, you know, and I had been the kid who never got picked on the team until last. I had a terrible, terrible shyness around the opposite sex. A few years ago, a TV show came on that had a character who had to drink to be able to talk to the opposite sex, and everybody finds it very funny. That was literally me. I am a recovering alcoholic because I could not talk to women. Because I remember being in high school saying, I'm never going to drink because I'm never going to turn into the people my parents were. Yet, I found this wonderful elixir that turned me from this absolutely frozen person among the opposite sex to, you know, in my mind, James Bond, you know. I would have a couple of drinks of hello, darling, you know. And British accent and all. But the reality is, the reason I did is because I felt so terrible about myself. And I could not talk. And I was incredibly shy. And, you know, even, you know, I tell people that, and this didn't really even happen that much, but early in my recovery, I used to say I have the personality of the anti-stalker. You know, a stalker is the kind of person who, when he asks a girl out and she says no, he won't take no for an answer, he's coming back, he's bothering her, etc. I would ask somebody out and I would say, would you like to go out on Saturday night? And she might have been saying, gee, I have something to do Saturday night, but I'd love to go out with you some other time. Well, by the time she got to G, I was like, okay, never mind. And I'd run away. But of course, these are two of the same sides of the same coin, because it was all about, I want to protect myself. And so I immediately, you know, pushed away and things like that. And it took me many, many years of recovery to be able to get to the point of having some self-esteem to be able to do that. I always talk in my story that I have had every possible part of this disease. I have been mostly a compulsive overeater, but I have gone through a bulimic phase. I've gone through an exercise bulimic phase. And one time in my life, when I first came to OA, did I go through an anorexic phase. And let me just explain what that was about. When you're a fat kid, and you've been a fat kid your whole life, and a fat adult, you have this idea of what goal weight's going to be. And when the phrase goal weight comes up, it's almost like you can hear angels singing, goal weight! You know, I had this idea, oh, I'm going to be at goal weight, and I'm going to become self-confident, and women are going to be clinging at my ankles as I walk down the street, and, you know, total fantasy stuff, but a lot of things built up with goal weight. Well, I come into OA, I'm a male of 26, 27 years old, the metabolism of a hummingbird, so I lose the weight like that. I get to goal weight, and I look around, and I don't feel any different. The only thing that happened when I got to goal weight is I got to goal weight. And so a part of my weird brain said, well, I guess that wasn't the right number, so I need to lose another 10 pounds. And I lost another 10 pounds, and I didn't like myself anymore. I didn't feel any better about myself. I didn't have any confidence. Well, I'll lose another 10 pounds. And finally, somewhere around, I mean, I remember being a size 29 waist. I was like 140-something pounds. I'm like 50 pounds more than that now. And the point was, I couldn't get, until finally I had a, you know, people saying, eat, for God's sakes, this is crazy, that it started to sink in that there's no number on a scale that is going to validate how I feel about myself. Now, I got to say, I think I had to go through that. You know, there's an old joke when people say, well, you know, just because you're rich doesn't mean you're going to be happy. And everybody always says, yeah, well, let me be rich first, and then I'll validate that for you. Well, I think I had to do that. I had to get to that goal weight to be able to get, no, there is no number on a scale that's going to make that any better. The other thing I always like to share, I mean, this sounds pandering coming from a male in a mostly female organization, but I truly believe women have it harder when it comes to weight loss and dealing with this than men do. And I'll tell you why, because when I was 26 and I lost all my weight, I was clueless. I mean, I didn't have any sisters. I didn't have any real female friends. Like I said, I could hardly talk to females, so actually having one as a friend was, you know, not really that possible either. So I had no idea of this whole thing with signals, you know. And having been an ex-comic, I can tell you Jerry Seinfeld used to do this whole bit on the male-female signal thing and how we guys are just clueless. It's way too subtle for us because we don't get it. Well, in addition to that, imagine if on top of that you're a fat kid who whole life has felt like unattractive and not well. Women could have been looking at me and checking me out like crazy, and I would have just thought I had a booger on my shirt. You know, it wouldn't have dawned on me that they were interested in me. Or if it did flash through my head for a millisecond, it would have gotten shot down by, and excuse my language here, but I have a sponsee who calls that negative voice in your head K-Fuck Radio. shot down by K-Fuck, and it was, oh, don't be idiotic. She's not interested in you. And because of that, I just never could approach. Women, on the other hand, if you come in and you lose the weight, you're not afforded that ability to just be oblivious. You will get attention. You will have people approaching you. And that, you know, to me, it's, we were talking at lunch about how the sort of frustrating thing about attractiveness is we all want to be attractive, but we all want to have the ability to have the hands on the controls of the attractiveness filter. We want the attractiveness filter to only work on the people we want to attract, and everybody else should see us the way they do and leave us the hell alone. And unfortunately, you know, it doesn't work that way. And I know for me, because thank God I didn't have that, because I think that would have freaked me out too. And so I think, you know, it is one of the main causes of recidivism, especially with you know, younger women, because all of a sudden you have all this attention, you have all this stuff, and you know what? Going home and eating on a Saturday night all by yourself may on one hand be lousy, but it's simpler, it's easier, and most importantly, it's familiar. You know, there's an old axiom in psychology. People will choose what's familiar over what's good any day, because at least the familiar is something of which we have an idea of its scope, whereas everything else becomes so open, you know. But it's so funny, because I remember coming in, and I was a 26-year-old male, which I was trying to think of a good synonym for 26-year-old male, and asshole is the only thing that comes to mind, okay? Now, don't get me wrong. There are 26-year-old males out there that are wonderful guys, but I think the default behavior tends to be sort of asshole, and or at least arrogant and know-it-all and all that kind of stuff. We then have put that name on. And I remember when I first came in, and I lost the weight like this, and I got that instant abstinence, and it was just easy, and I would look at, why are these people having so much problems? They just do it, you know, it's really simple and all that. And of course, I had my own slip later and then got to experience that. It's like anything I, as a 26-year-old male, arrogant person, had to deal with, eventually, you know, that I poo-pooed, I had to deal with later, and that was one of them. The other one was, I would hear women say, oh, I came in, I lost the weight, I got attractive, I couldn't deal with it, I went back out. And I remember being, you know, that 26-year-old male going, these women are never happy. They're not happy if they're fat, they're not happy if they're thin, these people are just never going to be happy no matter what. Well, I ended up going through something very similar later. I was in program for a decent amount of time, I had become, as some of you guys know, I'd been a stand-up comic. I was out on the road a lot, 2-3 weeks at a time. And it's, first of all, anybody who doesn't know, comics aren't like rock musicians, okay? We're not being inundated with the opposite sex. We're you know, it's like rock musicians, rock roadies, rock, you know, things. The comics are way down, okay? But there is still occasionally an opportunity because you're on stage, you're the center of attention for 400 or 500 people or more. I mean, I've opened for concerts. So there was opportunity. Well, I started going through a major slip during that time, and I couldn't stay absent, and it took until a long time later in therapy I realized this was my protection. I didn't want to be unfaithful to my wife, so if I just start gaining weight and I put that heaviness on, it becomes a non-issue and I don't have to deal with it, you know. And there again, the irony of the things I want to poo-poo end up coming back and biting me in the end. The other thing, just you know, in talking about some of this, the it took me years, and this is, you know, all of this stuff that we talk about, I think you can go back, and if you're working these steps and you're working all these parts is what's going to bolster this. But I couldn't understand some of this because I wasn't, again, because I was raised as a fat kid, because I had such a, you know, abuse to me. You know, there was so much idea of my attractiveness. I had a friend, and I think Sheila probably remembers Scott from Hal. It was another stand-up comic. Scott, I don't think Scott ever got under 300 pounds. Scott was a chick magnet. Okay? Now, and it just, I could not understand this. But here's the thing. Scott liked himself. Scott had been raised differently than I had. He had wonderful self-esteem. He was funny. And, you know, intellectually, I would read this stuff. You know, oh, gee, women like funny guys. They like smart guys. They like caring guys. Yet, I'm still the fat guy in there, you know, and I'm still the person, and I couldn't really get that. And it was just always interesting to me to have Scott as a barometer and to realize that as a compulsive eater, I made 99% of the attractiveness quotient for me about the weight. And there's so much more about attractiveness than weight. But when this has been your whole life of eating and not eating and food and not food and getting on a scale, we, I think, put it out of proportion to where it really is, you know. I was telling a story to Ann on the phone about a friend from Howe, Gabby, you may remember. And I remember she would get up every day, she'd be pitching all the time, you know, as soon as I get to go weight this, and as soon as I get to go weight that. And I finally grabbed her one day and I said, you know, you're the only person in the world who doesn't know you're not at goal weight. And you're, and I think the fear of getting abstinent is equal sometimes to the fear of declaring victory, you know, and that there's this magic line, and then when I get it, I'll start. And I know so many people who have put their social lives, their dating lives, and everything on hold until they get to be the perfect person. And if I have one recommendation, it's not to do that, you know. The part about me that took a long time to change was how I approached the dating thing. I joke, I said I would go into meeting women like Oliver Twist. You know, I would come up with the bowl going, please, sir, I want some more, you know? And that was, it's a little hard to even mention, but this is honestly, I remember saying to a therapist once, when I'm asking a girl out, I feel like a car salesman trying to unload a piece of shit car that he hopes will just stay intact until it gets off his lot. And it was a really sad thing that I had that kind of feeling. And I remember one of my therapists, you know, asking me, well, what is it you find attractive in a woman? And I remember saying, well, the fact that she shows any interest in me whatsoever. And he laughed at John's time, you know, time to start setting that bar a little higher. But that really was a lot of what it was, because I was so terribly shy. You practically had to hit me over the head for me to be able to. And the idea of pursuing somebody to do that, oh, forget it, you know. My immediate thing goes back to, you know, being the last kid picked and getting laughed at. And the idea, and I'm, there's an old thing Dennis Miller used to say, because I can't be gay, it's hard enough getting rejected by women, they at least have some tact. But in my mind, you know, if I ask somebody out and they might say, gee, I'm not really interested, in my mind it wouldn't be, gee, I'm not interested, be, you little troll, get out of here. That was what was in my head. Now, it's not what would ever happen, but it's the way I would have felt, even if they'd have said it as nicely as they could. I would have translated in my head as, you ugly troll, get out of here. How dare you even ask? How, you know? And it took a long time to change it. And the other thing that happened as a result of that is I was an incredible people pleaser. You know, I was Zelig. I don't know if you folks ever saw the Woody Allen movie Zelig, about a guy who is constantly changing physically to fit his surroundings. Well, it was me. What? You like Chinese opera? I love Chinese opera. You know, whatever. Oh, you like to go antiquing on Sundays? Yes, I'll go antiquing on Sundays. But that was what it meant, because there wasn't a me in here. You know, and I remember talking to, you know, I had this goal. I remember talking to a therapist about, I wanted to be that kind of James Bond who could go up and talk to him. And then, you know, and of course, I'm in like 30s maybe. You know, I want to end up in bed with him. Well, he said, John, as long as you're making that a barometer, even if you became James Bond tomorrow and you went up to 100 women in a row and you were successful with 99 of them in a row, the 100th one who says no to you is going to crumble you into 1,000 pieces. And I realized he was absolutely right, because I was making my value based on whether you liked me, whether you thought I was attractive, and I couldn't do it that way. The other thing I had a hard time with for a while was saying no. And I don't mean, you know, sex kind of stuff, but I meant I had trouble if some girl was interested in me and I didn't have the same interest in her, being able to say no. And I think part of it was I had a lifetime of identifying with the rejectee, and all of a sudden I have to be the rejector, and it's so gut-wrenching to me. Why would I want to inflict that on somebody? And I literally dated a woman for about 3 months that I had no interest in, because she had actually asked me out and wanted to go out, and it was a disservice to both of us. It was, I couldn't see that at the time, but it was a horrible disservice to her to go along, and I think she finally realized it, and I think that's how it ended, you know. And I'm gonna wrap up in a minute so Anne can have her shot here to talk about herself. But one of the real successes is working this program, and for me, I'm a big believer in outside help if you need it. You know, it's in the big book. We're not experts. We're not professionals. I've had wonderful sponsors who've helped me with things. I've also had wonderful sponsors who've had the guts to be able to say, you know what, my old sponsor, who's not my sponsor now, I was having a trouble in something with women, and he said, John, I'm a gay man, can't help you. And you know what, it was so wonderful that he had the self-esteem to not have to have all the answers. And that's the great thing, and I'll say about this program, I'm a huge believer in the it takes a village thing. You know, you may be going through stuff with losing weight and getting thin, and you've got a booby grandmother who hasn't been hit on in 40 years. Nothing wrong with that, but she's not going to be able to help you with that. There are wonderful people here who will be able to help you. And I think that having this and working steps and keeping the focus on what is my part in all of these things helped so much. And I got to a point where the self-esteem slowly started to get to the point. And the success story I will tell you is I was married once. That didn't work out. My second marriage, I did something I never did before. I actually pursued my wife. The idea of putting myself out, and in the beginning, she wasn't interested. You know, I don't know if you watched the other night, Joe Biden was talking about how he asked his wife 7 times to marry him. I couldn't imagine that. But I did. I didn't take no at first. I wasn't a stalker. But I went, you know, maybe I'll try again, you know, because I realized, you know, one of the great things about program is it never tells you you're never going to experience problems. It tells you if you work this program and you work on yourself and you get a higher power, whatever problem you have, you will be able to get through to the other side without dying. And that's what I came to be able to see, you know, and to make myself vulnerable from the background I had of both my parents' family situation and having been the kid who was mercilessly, you know, ridiculed as a kid, to put myself out there, it's a huge step, you know. And I'll wrap up with something I heard. I heard this story once at a meeting when I was maybe a year sober. I never heard it again, but it made such an impact, it's been in there forever. And that is the analogy of the lobster. You know, in life, a lobster really only has one protective thing in the sea against a lot of predators, and that's its shell. It has a shell to protect it. But once a year, it has to molt. And the reason it molts is it has to get out of that shell, because the shell also constricts it. And if the lobster is going to grow, it has to be willing to pull out of the shell to grow. And I remember thinking, that is a really heavy, deep thought. And that's one of the things through the program I was finally able to do, to get to the point where I could put myself, I could be the lobster without a shell and live to tell the tale. And that's what a lot of this program's done. So that's my part of my opening story, and I'm going to now turn it over to Anne.
Thanks, John. Okay.
Anne,
I'm the overeater.
Hi, Anne.
So, thank you, John. He's done this many times before. I haven't. But in playing off that last story about the lobster, I was just writing to a sponsee the other night in which she was saying she had a hard time claiming who she really was in the world. And I think there's a reason why John and I are not in our 20s in leading this, because I don't really think I knew who I was for a long, 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 long time. And so, if I had to talk to my younger self, I would say it's okay, and that you will struggle. It's hard, and you may not know. I don't know that our culture really encourages knowing who we are. My mom would always say, well, stop asking for advice. You know inside. And I'm going, no, I don't. And they talk about the third eye in meditation, which is inner wisdom, and it's the color is deep purple. And sometimes when I meditate, I really can connect with that and feel like I do know. But it may just be age. And so, anyway, so it's that willingness. Okay, so what I was saying to my sponsor in my email was, I think everyone is given a square of earth that we can, it's a great white tile, and that's ours to populate. And for the longest time, I was like curled in the corner because I am such a big personality, and I didn't want to offend anybody. I was fragile, so I just assumed everybody was fragile, and so I was protecting them. And now I feel like I've spread out, and I can be colorful, and they can handle it. And I really do think some of that is just age. So if you're not able to do that, then also don't worry. Just to qualify, I've been in programs since 1975. I came in when I was in college. It took me 6 years to get abstinent. I've lost between 50 and 60 pounds. So my abstinence date is February 11, 1981. And, my sponsor has always said that my most important story is that I stumbled and I didn't know what I was doing, and I would abstain and then binge and abstain and then binge, but I stayed. So that's my story. So I've been abstinent for 31 years. And in the last about 10 years, I lost 10 pounds, which made me feel finally that I was normal weight. And it was, and I actually, at some point in my absence, very, very early in like 1982, I'd gotten down to a really thin weight. I'm about 133 right now, but I got down to be like 120, and I was so excited because that was my high school weight, and it lasted about a minute. And I didn't. First of all, I don't really think I saw it. I think sometimes, for me, I had to grow into it. You have to be that way for a long, long time to claim it. So I didn't really see myself as thin. And also, I was colder, physically colder. The backs of my bones stuck out on my chair, so I was less comfortable on a chair. I don't think I looked too skinny, but I definitely understood then why I overate, because noises were too loud. My emotions that I was feeling were too loud. Colors were too loud. I was using my extra food, and I still do, to turn down the volume. It's so clear to me. I turned down the volume. So the last 10 pounds were a challenge because I do feel more. But I'll talk a little bit about that now. I know it's a hot day, and I know we're doing all we can with the fans and the doors open, but there's water here, and we encourage people to get up and drink. It's tough, but hot. That's where we're supposed to be today, right? Hot. Right. So today I was walking my dog. I live in Manhattan Beach. I was walking on the Strand, and I was thinking, I think the two keys here are to try to be in joy and to try to be present. And that's maybe just the key to life. And then maybe the third one is to be self-compassionate. And that's probably much more important than anything, because the self-compassionate comes from, I'm not there yet, I can't, like, I don't even know myself yet, or I don't like my body yet. Or, you know, the other day I had coffee and I was so excited, my latte was at home, and then I spilled it in the car. And so I was able to go, okay, so what's the word, your new word is self-compassionate? Oh well, no big deal. You know, it's like, it's not that big a deal, nothing's a big deal. And if I have too much at one sitting, oh well, there's this wonderful feeling of self-compassion. Not about anything else. But anyway, the funny thing that happened today when I was walking, I was thinking, okay, it's joy and it's being present. It's joy and being present. And I'm not joyful and I'm not present to you. I'm trying to remember those two. So that happens to me in sex too, when I'm thinking, I have to be this way. So I'm certainly not, you know, I'm certainly not present when I'm thinking, what do I have to be? The color of my notes is orange because the orange chakra is a sexual chakra. And when I'm meditating, I was taught to go through the different colors. And I don't know if this means anything to you, but I'll just tell you what I was told. That the one, the base one that anchors you to the ground is kind of red, the deep red of earth. And I was told to kind of wash that up and down inside me as I'm meditating. And then the next one is orange, which is sexual. And when I wash that up and down with me, sometimes I actually get turned on. I mean, it's really interesting. Or I think about my husband and myself. Or it's interesting when I don't feel sexual when I think of that orange, or I can't really see orange very well. And then the next one is a bright yellow, which is creativity. And I'm a writer, so on the days when my yellow is kind of dull, I don't always see that very well. And the next one is green, which is love, and sometimes I feel it and sometimes I don't. And the next one is the throat, and it's talking and communicating, and it's blue. And then the deep purple of inner wisdom. And for me, the final one is just the white. So I connect myself to the heaven and to earth with this beautiful white light. It has nothing to do with anything, but I just thought I would share that because it's the orange paper. And it's true. I went online and I looked up, you know, big book and sex to see what it had to do. And it's true what John said on page 69. It says, in other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it to. And if it doesn't, I'm self-compassionate. And I think that's really important. And then on page 70, it says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. So it's really just being a human being. And I have no idea what time I started, John, so if you remember, you'll help me. Okay. So, a little bit about me. I grew up in Southern California and Northern California. Both of my parents were extremely attractive. My mom was a performer. My father was a farmer. But they were just like movie star attractive. So that became the most important value in our house, just sort of a default character. And the way I handled it was that I figured they were A's and I would just be a B. You know, it was just easier, just not even to compete. And it's not that they were asking or expecting it to be a competition, but that's how I dealt with a lot of things. So my sister was really smart. She was an A student, so I just thought I would sit beside and be the creative one. I didn't even, you know, she's the journalist and gets the facts right, and I'm not. My father was gone a lot because our farm is in Northern California, and so I didn't have a lot about role modeling with men. I didn't see, it was just my sister, myself, and my mom. I didn't really know what male organs looked like, but maybe most people don't. I mean, maybe that's appropriate. I didn't see them holding hands a lot or being affectionate, although they liked each other a lot, but I didn't see that. And maybe it was just the 50s. You know, it wasn't really a demonstrative time in our culture. My best friend in elementary school was Shelley, and she and I practiced kissing. And that was really embarrassing when I had a hickey once and someone saw it. You know, it was like I was 12 or something, and it was just so embarrassing. And I just felt so wrong and so bad, and it's just life, you know. And I can look back and be self-compassionate, but I just felt so awful. I am a compulsive personality, so when I got into puberty, two things happened. I began to sneak food in my family, and I just It was what probably held me together as I was changing and becoming sexual or becoming more aware in the world. But also I was really into masturbation, and I think it's the same thing as compulsive overeating. I think it turns down my volume, it dulls me, it distracts me, it also makes me go to sleep easily, you know. So again, not to be self-condemning, but I was so self-condemning at the time. I just thought it was horrible. There was a man at the farm, who's a farm manager, who my sister and I felt was not safe. And my mom discounted that. Now, we were never hurt by him, but I wished it had been different, where she was able to say, huh, that's interesting, let's keep you away from him. I just got the vibe that he still thought we were the cutest little young, gangly teenagers, you know. I was oblivious a lot of my growing up life. So I was not of this world. And so as I began to become a young woman, I did not see the attention. I was not aware of it at all. And so I just assumed it wasn't there. I now see it was. In fact, I also didn't know that I was a cute little kid. I look back at pictures and I think, what was I worried about? I thought I was heavy when I was 13 and 14. I was not. But I don't know what I was judging. It was our culture. Was it my mom who was so pretty? I don't know what I was judging. But I think for me, the disease compulsive overeating, and I said this a lot, is as much a disease of perception, self-perception and perception as it is of anything else. That when I was in college, I remember I gained, you know, what's called the freshman 15. I remember being so, maybe I went from an 8 to a 10, you know, I think I'm a 10 now, I don't know what I am. And I remember walking back onto the campus to the dorms wearing my new size 10 and just feeling horrible and fat, and someone was on a top floor and whistled at me. And it was that disconnect. I did not see what other people saw. When I was in college, I moved into a co-ed dorm because I didn't know boys. I wanted to know, what was it like to live with boys, and who are they? And I actually had trouble going to the bathroom. I couldn't go to the bathroom in a co-ed dorm. I went to my sister's, like a block away, because she lived in an apartment, because I was just so uptight and scared, and I began to eat a lot in the dorm. And, you know, a lot of things going on in college. And a lot of that, for me, that rawness of, I'm a person without too many screens, and so the screen is overeating and the screen is gaining weight. That can protect me from all the overwhelm, and it still sometimes does. I fantasized about being in a large family. My mom was one of 11 brothers and sisters, and so I moved to a co-op, which was in the middle 70s, so it was, you know, the hippie time, and I had a great time. I loved living in the co-op. And it was also a safe place to find my first sexual boyfriend. And the way I decided to sleep with him is that I could trust him enough to fall asleep with him. The other people I didn't trust, I could not fall asleep with, you know, and I didn't. But this guy, he was safe. I could fall asleep with him. Also, the night I lost my virginity, I was over to professor's house studying with a bunch of kids, and I looked at the time and I thought, oh, I have to go, it's late, and I got home, and his clock was an hour fast. So I had an extra hour. So I lost my virginity. like 5 more minutes? So when I joined OA, so I came into OA in 1975, and I was in college starting in 72, so I was, my father died suddenly 6 months after I joined OA. And so OA for me became a place where I cried a lot about my father's death and a lot about not having a man for years. I was very slow to date or hook up with people or to have long-term relationships. When I finally met the man who became my husband, I had not had anything longer than a 5-month dating relationship with anyone. I met him in 1980. And he had always had 2-year relationships, 4-year relationships. You know, he had a long, long... And I didn't know what it was like to survive arguments and to go through something. If it was hard, I left. Or he left. Or I was scared, and we both left. The thing about being with my husband, who we've been together 32 years, he's even more the best friend than he was when I married him. The thing that angered me, though, was I was just getting a handle on my absence. So I got absence in 1981, and then about 9 months later we got married. But I had met him before I was on the absence I claim today. And as I was getting absent and I was feeling good about myself, we would be in a car. He would stop to get gasoline. He'd get out of the car, and I'd be hungry. As soon as he got out of the car, I was hungry. And I was angry because that didn't happen to me before with other relationships. And I didn't care for it, thank you very much. And I'm like, oh, really? So that was interesting. The other thing is you talked about intimacy, and my husband doesn't like to hold hands. And I'm a very touchy-feely massage me. I took a massage class so we would both learn how to do it, and I learned how to massage. You know, it's like nothing happened as a result of that. And it was really hard for me. I felt very rejected. Just like to hold hands. Until I got pregnant many years later, in which I was hot. I was physically really hot, and my husband runs hot. He's like my heating pad. I touch him, I warm up. And I didn't want to hold hands when I was pregnant and hot, and I understood from a different place what that may have been. It wasn't about him rejecting me. And finally, 13 years into our marriage, my therapist and I were talking about, and I had been with him for many years, and she said, you know, actually, I have to tell you that the one thing that concerned me when you first walked into my office was you said, I've been married so-and-so years and we've never had an argument. And, you know, you were so proud of it. And she said, that concerned me because two adults in the same place, they will have differences. And that was an interesting thing that I thought eventually we'd get to. And so when we did get into it, 13 years in our relationships, I saw that we were both terrified of conflict. And we would both run the other way, or if I would say something challenging or asking or whatever that he didn't want, I would be back up and back up and back up. When I felt that feeling in that house, you know, when you have that, the air becomes thick and there's this kind of discomfort, I would just back up and make nice and never mind, and, you know, it's like tiptoe out of the room. And what she said is, as you get comfortable with tolerating the discomfort, you will be able to be hungry when it's not appropriate to eat. And that really has been true for me, that tolerating the discomfort of the feelings in our relationship and tolerating the discomfort of being hungry was very similar. So, thank you.
Great.